Hello there. Today is Wednesday, January 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Iran retaliates against the U.S. with dozens of missile strikes on two U.S. military bases in Iraq.
U.S. allies, Australia included, are deeply worried now about the prospect of Iranian attacks that will see their troops targeted.
Climate change could mean even after Australia's horrific bushfires are contained, they won't be the last. Also ahead, some very strange new gadgets unveiled at a massive electronics exhibition. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard launched a revenge operation for the assassination of Quds Force leader Qasem Soleimani, firing dozens of rockets at bases hosting American troops in Anbar, Iraq. The IRGC is a branch of the Iranian Armed Forces. Joining us now live from Washington to talk more about the latest, what's going on, White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, thanks for being with us.
Sure, Lori.
What exactly do we know at this point?
What we know is that the Iranians target two U.S. bases with a number of missiles. All indications are that there were no casualties, no Iraqis at those bases in Iraq, or Americans have been killed or wounded, according to the latest information. But officials at the White House and Defense Department are cautioning that until it's daylight and they make a thorough assessment, we won't have a full indication of the extent of damage. Now, missiles can be guided in flight. Rockets, you sort of aim them, and wherever they end up, they end up. So there is some speculation that the Iranians wanted to send a message of retaliation, but not cause an escalation that would have compelled the president of the United States to attack Iran as he has threatened. Hmm. We had a number of really tense hours there after we got word that these missiles had been launched. And of course, the president has tweeted that all is well, and that he will make a statement tomorrow. The top officials who did huddle in the West Wing of the White House this evening, including the Defense Secretary, the National Security Advisor, and the Secretary of State, have gone home. So we are not expecting anything further to come out of the White House tonight.
Now, the president's tweeting all is well. Are we sure that all is well, or is this just the president's normal just trying to, you know, make, you know, downplay any potential problems with American troops or injuries?
Yes, it could also indicate that the president does not intend to turn tensions up another notch and back away from the cusp of war. The messages we've seen from the Iranians this evening, including the foreign minister, are that Iran does not want war. There are also indications from the Iranian military that as long as the United States now does not attack Iran, that this is it, that there will not be war. But if there is a military response by the United States on targets inside Iran, that would lead to a further round of retaliation by Iran striking out at U.S. allies, including Israel.
So, you know, that's obviously very frightening for, you know, Israel and other allies. But are there any indications that if in fact there have been American troops killed in these attacks, that the president will retaliate and then against the retaliation?
Yes. If there had been indications, if we had gotten confirmation that there were dead Americans as a result of these missile attacks tonight, the president, based on what he had said earlier today, would have been compelled to retaliate militarily. That is what we have heard from officials at the White House and the Defense Department.
All right. I guess we will. Will we hear more tomorrow from the president?
He has promised that he will make a statement tomorrow.
Okay. Great. We appreciate your taking the time to talk to us and fill us in. Thank you so
sure.
much. That's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Meanwhile, talking more about the implications going forward of this, what seems to be a continuing escalation or situation between the U.S. and Iran, is John Blaxland, professor of international security and intelligence studies at the Australian National University's Strategic and Defense Studies Center. This, of course, started with the killing of Iran's top general. No one seems to dispute the fact that he was a bad man. Thanks for being with us.
So Qasem Soleimani is a notorious Iranian special forces commander who is an odious character who deserved to die. But the circumstances in which he died are extremely problematic, not only for the United States, but for its allies. And that's because it has brought into the equation the Iraqi government, which has obviously reacted understandably to the killing at their own airport in Baghdad of not only Soleimani but other Iraqi citizens, senior Iraqi officials, at a time when the United States had asked Iraq to act as an intermediary with Iran. So there is a real toxic backlash developing, not only inside parliament, but across many parts of Shia Iraq against the United States presence. And that, in the long run, may prove extremely counterproductive for the United States' role and for the West's presence in Iraq and elsewhere. And this affects others. It affects Australia. It affects NATO allies, Britain and France and others as well, who have been working alongside the United States.
Can you talk a little bit about how this will impact all these other places?
In Iraq itself, there are national contributions from a number of U.S. allies, Australia included, that are deeply worried now about the prospect of Iranian attacks that will see their troops directly targeted. But beyond that, there are real concerns about Iranian actions beyond the borders, not just in Iraq, but elsewhere, be it in Lebanon, in the Strait of Hormuz, be it in other parts of the Persian Gulf and beyond. We've seen in the last 18 months a number of actions that have already been intimidatory and gravely concerning, not the least of which was the attack on the Saudi oil refineries, that point to a level of desperation by Iran to break the American-led sanctions. And this action takes it to a new level in terms of the urgency the Iranians probably feel to act towards developing their nuclear weapons capability. And also, it has the effect of dampening down, if not completely suppressing, the popular movement inside Iran to call for further change and reform, if not change of government entirely. Essentially, the changes we've witnessed in the last few years in Iran, incremental changes, have been wound back essentially because not only technologies allowed the Iranian government to be more controlling, but the expressions of sympathy for reform and for democratization, for change of government and the like, are now directly and categorically identified inside Iran as being pro-Western and therefore anti-Iranian. And that is, in the long run, perhaps the greatest blowback for this killing of Soleimani.
And, of course, the situation with Iraq asking the U.S. to basically leave the country, that means all U.S. service members. And
there's some speculation about that yet, though. That may not be a done deal. My understanding is that the Prime Minister has some discretion about what to do in response to that vote of the Parliament. And we need to remember, of course, also that appearances matter, and that form precedes function. This action is deeply humiliating for the Iraqi government,
mm-hmm.
and that some action to compensate for that humiliation has to be done.
How concerned are you for this whole thing to escalate into a much larger and dangerous situation?
This is deeply concerning. There's no question this is deeply concerning. The prospect of escalation greater than they've been for a while, but there remains enduring incentives for both Iran and the United States to avoid further escalation. The United States, under President Trump, has made it very clear that it does not want a war with Iran, and that, in fact, it has essentially sought to extricate itself from the wars in Iran, Iraq, and elsewhere. And the Trump administration's actions have been very much carefully calibrated to avoid escalation, while rhetorically has been very escalatory in one sense, but the actions have been quite modest. My sense is that the actions will continue to be modest while the bluster will remain. And similarly, conversely, from the Iranian side, there's an important imperative domestically to continue to demonize the United States because of the sanctions and the imposition on Iran, and also to help consolidate Iranian grip over the Levant. And so there's an imperative there for the rhetoric to be maintained and for actions to be seen to support that view. But deep down, both sides know a serious escalation is not in their interest and would be extremely harmful to both of them and their interests in the Middle East.
All right, John Blaxland. He is a professor of international security and intelligence studies at the Australian National University's Strategic and Defense Studies Center. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. will not grant Iran's foreign minister a visa for a visit to the U.N. in New York. Humanitarian conditions worsen for millions in Syria's Idlib. U.S. trade deficit falls to the lowest level in more than 3 years. And a new phone is just for kids with no internet access and no app store. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. At least 4 Kenyan students were killed and 4 more injured when suspected al-Shabaab terrorists attacked a primary school in Garissa County near the border with Somalia. The Kenyan military says they killed 2 of the attackers as they tried to blow up a telecommunications tower. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenyan police say al-Shabaab terrorists attacked Saredo Primary School in a remote village in Garissa County early Tuesday morning. Charles Owino is a Kenya police spokesman.
About 12 al-Shabaab attackers attacked an area called Saretho. Saretho is within Dadaab sub-county, Garissa County, 25 kilometers from Dadaab center. And they killed a teacher and 3 other persons, a total of 4 people.
Owino says one child was killed and others injured in the attack. He says security officers fought off the attackers as they then tried to destroy a telecommunications tower with improvised explosive devices.
And they attempted to destroy the telecommunications Safaricom mast around that place. A patrol caught up with them and shot and killed 2 of them, and we recovered 2 AK-47 rifles and some IEDs that they had planted at the telecommunication area.
Al-Shabaab militants launched frequent attacks in northeastern Kenya near the border with Somalia. The Islamist group wants Kenyan troops to leave Somalia, where they have been helping African Union forces battle the militants. On Sunday, the Islamist group attacked a military base in Lamu, Kenya, that hosts U.S. and Kenyan counter-terrorism forces, killing 3 U.S. personnel and damaging several aircrafts. In one of the worst attacks in 2015, al-Shabaab gunmen stormed Garissa University, killing 148 people, most of them students. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A strong earthquake struck Puerto Rico early Tuesday, causing power outages and structural damage. At least one person has been killed in a series of quakes that hit the island in recent days. Governor Wanda Vasquez has declared a state of emergency and asked for a federal emergency declaration. VOA's Latika Hoke reports.
The Caribbean island, which is a U.S. territory, has been hit by a series of quakes in the past days, with the strongest striking early Tuesday. Puerto Rico Governor Wanda Vasquez warned citizens that the seismic activity could continue.
We have communicated with the United States Geological Survey, and they have informed us that this type of movement may continue for the next few days. We must be prepared, and we must have our individual and family plans ready in case new tremors occur.
Schools and government offices were closed Tuesday, and many residents were afraid to return home for fear of collapsing structures.
There is a feeling of panic because we are expecting something stronger to happen, something worse. And really, there is a feeling of instability and panic with people here from this town.
On Monday morning, a 5.8 magnitude quake struck the island, destroying five homes in the southwest coastal town of Guanica and causing severe damage to many others. The quake was followed by a string of smaller tremors. Then, before dawn Tuesday, a stronger quake, measuring a magnitude of 6.4, struck the southern coast. The governor said Puerto Rico has not experienced such a situation in more than 100 years.
We are talking about something for which we could not prepare, like for hurricanes, which we can see coming and have different information so we can protect our property. We are talking about a situation that happens without notice.
Vasquez said she has requested help from the National Guard to assist residents in the wake of the earthquake. Puerto Rico is still recovering from devastating Hurricane Maria that hit the island in September of 2017, killing about 3,000 people and destroying much of the infrastructure. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
In Australia, where out-of-control bushfires continue to create horrific damage, residents are dealing with extreme stress and anxiety.
I've had such high anxiety levels that I've barely been able to get out of my own house. We had to evacuate at 4 o'clock in the morning on Sunday from a property that was over the road from us that was cleared farmland. And it was a 4 kilometre drive down to the Toowoomba Hall. And I've never been so scared in my life. I couldn't see, the smoke was so thick. There was a roar of fire.
Joining us from Canberra is Dr. Jeff Carey, Associate Professor of Bushfire Science at the Australian National University. Thanks for being with us. So what's the latest on the situation?
Laurie, these fires in eastern and southern Australia have been burning since September. A lot of these fires were ignited by lightning, but some other causes of ignition as well. There's been over 8 million hectares burned by these fires. That's over 80,000 square kilometres. For comparison, that would be about a third of the land area of the United Kingdom. The number of fatalities tragically sits at 27, and there's been about 2,000 houses destroyed. Recent estimates in terms of the insurance cost is about $700 million, but I think there's no doubt that that is going to increase pretty dramatically. What is required to extinguish these fires is soaking and extended rainfall.
Mm.
There's no sign of a rainfall in the near-term forecast, although climatologists are talking about the climate drivers switching to a more neutral state, which could give us milder, moister conditions at some time over the next few months.
You've had this drought. Obviously, you haven't had enough rain to do anything about it, and of course, we can only presume that the ground being so dry, it's turning into kindling, and this thing is creating a life within itself. I imagine this would be heavily related to climate change and something that everyone would need to take as a big warning.
Yes. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about climate change influences on these fires in Australia and around the world. Yes, we are experiencing a very extended drought in Australia. In southeastern Australia, the drought commenced in 2017, and that was related to temperature dynamics in the Indian Ocean and also circulation patterns around the southern pole. And these are combined, along with other factors, to give us a very low rainfall over the last 3 years. And in particular, we've had very, very low rainfall during the winter months over the last 3 years. And this is the time when the soil moisture can typically recharge in this part of the world. Australia has just experienced its warmest and dry year on record. And I think it's widely known that the average temperature in Australia and more broadly has increased by just over 1 degree Celsius over the last 100 years. So it is reasonable to conclude that climate change is influencing the extent of bushfires in southern and eastern Australia, including during this current bushfire season.
Well, this is so catastrophic, not just with the loss of human life, with the loss of homes, and of course the enormity of the wildlife that has been impacted by this. And if it is truly being relayed, being caused by, or certainly accelerated by climate change, with a tragedy on this scale, of this magnitude, how big are the concerns that even when this finally does get contained or put out, that this isn't going to be something Australia and other parts of the world are going to have to deal with happening again?
There's ongoing concern about the future bushfire seasons in Australia. There is no doubt that this would have been a bad bushfire season in Australia without the effects of global warming. What has been the case, and our research that involves running landscape fire models under the influence of various global warming scenarios for forest systems in southeastern Australia, shows that warmer scenarios invariably result in greater area burned. Some of our earlier work almost 20 years ago involved a 2-degree temperature increase scenario in a landscape fire model, and it resulted in a doubling of the area burned in the model system. So it's reasonable to assume that global warming has enhanced the severity of this bushfire season. Not every season is going to be disastrous in the future or in the past. It's that enhancement or that greater severity of the bushfire season that we're seeing here that is likely to be resulted back to warmer temperatures and drier conditions in Australia.
Going forward, how concerned are you and other professionals that are looking at what's happening and the change of the climate in Australia? How concerned are you about the ability to just deal with something on this magnitude as it continues to just get worse every year with the warming of the planet?
There is no doubt there's a great deal of concern within the Australian community about our capacity to deal with the current bushfire emergency and also planning for future emergencies. The state and federal governments are discussing at this point in time various reviews that will be conducted after this bushfire season. There has been suggestions that there may be a Royal Commission, which is the highest level of inquiry that can be conducted into events like this. It may be conducted at the federal level or at the state level. And if that's the case, it will result in a very thorough examination of not only the factors that led to this particular bushfire crisis, but the response by the state, federal agencies, response by the community in general, and identify improved ways going forward to deal with bushfires into the future. I think it would be fair to say, though, that any inquiry would have to consider noting that bushfires are with us to stay, particularly in a warming and drying climate. Australia will have to adjust to a greater bushfire risk than perhaps has been experienced in the past.
Dr. Geoffrey Carey, Associate Professor of Bushfire Science at the Australian National University. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Carey.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, it is all about technology, new technology, as the 2020 Consumer Electronics Show opens up in Las Vegas. It's the largest and most influential tech event, featuring more than 4,400 exhibitors, including 1,200 startups. Fortune contributing writer Chris Morris is there, and he joins us now from Las Vegas. Chris, I know the event just started, but what new and exciting things are you seeing so far?
What we're seeing this year here at the show is they're sort of laying the groundwork for what's to come, I think is the best way to describe this year. Seeing a lot of 8K TVs. Everyone's, you know, just a lot of people are just getting their first 4K set right now. But 8K is kind of what's next down the road, and you have to sort of feed the market with those, and so that's what they're starting to do at this point.
What is 8K?
8K, if you take the resolution that is on a 4K TV and double it, basically. So it is that much sharper a picture. It's especially good on larger screens. You can really see a difference there. You got to get somewhere around 70 inches or so. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of people are buying those sets these days. 50 inches is considered a relatively small TV set.
Wow. And so these are still flat screens, though, correct?
Oh, yeah. Very flat screens, impossibly thin as well. I mean, some of them about as thin as a pencil at this point.
Wow.
But that's just what the technology. And you're also seeing TVs that rotate because, you know, a lot of people, when they film things on their phone, they do it in the up and down mode, the portrait mode. And so the TV will flip so you can actually have that and not have those black bars if you decide to watch it, your home shot video on your TV.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. What else are you expecting and what else is new and exciting that we should know about?
I think the other thing that you're hearing a lot about this year is some 5G phones are sort of being hinted at here. Those will come out more at Mobile World Congress. But 5G is starting to take off now. It's going to be a few years, like the 8K sets, before it's really widespread. But everyone's excited about it because there's so much you can do with that technology. Imagine the speed of a broadband connection in your house on your phone. And all that you could do with that. That's going to be one of the biggest changes you're going to see in the years to come in terms of technology. It'll be incorporated into everything, cars, your cell phone, your tablets, your TV. It is entirely possible that you will not have to pay a Comcast or Time Warner cable for an internet connection if you have a sufficient 5G connection in your home.
And of course, Chris, every year we see something super weird. What's the weirdest thing you've seen so far?
You know, there's always a lot of weird stuff at this show. I'm going to put a tie. I'm going to cop out and give you two answers here. There is a baseball cap that has air conditioning built into it.
Wow, that is unusual.
And there's also the smart diaper, which alerts you when your baby has done what babies do.
You're kidding me. A diaper that tells you when the baby needs to be changed because there's a little extra something in there?
Yes. Yes, there's technology in there. I guess in case you don't have a working nose.
Really? Is that something somebody's going to buy?
You know, the thing about CES is sometimes there are products that never necessarily will get bought, but the technology behind them can be used in other things. And sometimes it's entrepreneurs who think they have an idea that actually might catch on. So, yeah, there are a lot of misses here, and there are a lot of things that miss wildly. But at the same time, it's interesting to see the technology because it might spark someone else thinking of something else.
Okay. So how long is this thing going on?
It's going to be running probably through, let's try it again. It's going to be running through Saturday, and most of the main news of the show will be done by about Thursday afternoon or so.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to hearing more about what might turn up. Chris Morris is a contributing writer to Fortune magazine. We always appreciate it. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Taylor Swift and writer, director, producer Janet Mock are being honored at the GLAAD Media Awards for their advocacy for LGBTQ issues. The pop star will receive the Vanguard Award, which is presented to allies who have made significant difference in promoting acceptance of LGBTQ people. Mock is best known for her work on the FX series Pose, and she'll receive the Stephen F. Kolzak Award, presented to a LGBTQ media professional. They'll be honored at the GLAAD Media Awards in Los Angeles on April 16th. Swift has been an outspoken proponent for the Equality Act, which would prohibit discrimination based on sex, gender, or sexual orientation in a wide variety of areas. Her video for her hit, You Need to Calm Down, also featured prominent LGBTQ celebrities and mocked those who were against gay marriage. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. Must have taken all night. You just need to take several seats and then try to restore the peace and control your urges to scream about all the people you hate. Never made anybody less gay, so you need to calm down. You're being so loud. And I'm just like, you need to just stop. But can you just not step on his gown? You need to calm down.
who are killing it. But we figured you out. We all know now. We all got crowns. You need to calm down. Uh-oh, uh-oh.
This is